Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind. Until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Before we start, a content warning. This episode contains accounts of domestic and sexual violence. Hi there, I'm Justine Vanderloon, host of Believe Her. In this bonus episode, we're sharing an interview with a criminalized survivor. Her name is Sandra Brown, and you briefly heard from her in Chapter 6 of our series. Sandra is a mother and a grandmother, and I've been in touch with her for years while she's been incarcerated in Illinois state prisons. Sandra was sentenced to 22 years for murder, though she maintained she was attempting to protect herself during a fight with a family friend when a gun accidentally went off. Before Sandra was incarcerated, her traumas had gone unacknowledged and untreated. Like many people in women's prisons, she lived through childhood sexual and physical abuse, rape, and domestic violence. In prison, Sandra worked on rebuilding herself, acting in Shakespeare plays, mentoring young women, and earning her bachelor's and master's degrees. She's currently working toward her PhD. Today, Sandra is a visiting scholar at the Women's Justice Institute, and she lives in a transition center run by the state of Illinois. This Zoom interview you're about to hear is the first time we'd ever seen each other. She'd recently been released from prison after 21 years.
That's crazy.
It is. My goodness. I mean, how long have we been in touch, basically?
Years. Like, years.
Wow. So nice to finally see you. You know,
you
I mean,
too.
It's just, it's one thing, you know, I feel like we pretty much know each other in a way through correspondence and emails and bits and pieces of time on the phone when I could call from behind the walls, but just, you know, there's nothing that solidifies or deepens a connection or makes the connection more real than actually having the face attached to the person and the words and the, I can't wait till we can actually like be in the same space. But right now it's just amazing to share the same virtual space with you.
And I just like amazing to see you like on the screen with this phone. This is like a kind of crazy. I wasn't really thinking about it until we got on there. And I'm like, it's just amazing.
It's a voyage. It has been a voyage. It's been an adventure for sure.
What did you think reentry would look like?
You know, I would try to envision what it would look like, but you know, behind the walls when we're actually doing time in a, prison facility. I mean, because this is a prison facility also, but it's just prepared for reentry. It's more like a work release center rather than just a prison. We're away from technology. We're away from, you know, the reality outside on the other side of freedom. So it's hard. I can imagine. I imagine that I would first off be released from the prison itself, not at a work release center, because for so long we weren't women in my position were not eligible for work release. So that this changed in 2021 and we're now being allowed to come here, that's revolutionary in and of itself here in Illinois. So I did not see this as part of what my reentry would look like. If it did come, you know, I kept the possibility open, but I always looked at it as something that would happen once I was home, not necessarily while I still had time left to serve. So I felt like I would be at a huge disadvantage because I'd be out in the free community where I would have to either, quote unquote, sink or swim. So to have this structured kind of release where I get to actually learn some of these things and then have some kind of footing when I'm released out into the community, it's a huge benefit. Yes.
You served how many years?
I am at 21 years and 10 months. I have 104 days left, and by the time I am released, I will have served 22 years. I was sentenced to 22 years at 100%. My charge is first-degree murder, but here in the state of Illinois, first-degree murder falls under three different counts. Count one is premeditation and intent. I was convicted under count two, where I did not mean it, I did not plan it, but the state says I knew the bodily harm that could be caused. Otherwise, technically, it reads the same as second degree, which would be self-defense, but it carries first degree time. We fought over a gun that the victim pulled, and it discharged. It could have hit either one of us. It turned out that it hit her, and unfortunately, she passed away. I didn't even know that she had been hit by a bullet. I didn't know until after I'd gotten home and showered and got ready for work the next day. I did not even know.
So you consider yourself a criminalized survivor?
Absolutely. Yes, I am an incarcerated survivor. I do not fit the textbook description of an incarcerated survivor because I'm not sure of what the definition is in other states, but here in Illinois, incarcerated survivors seem to be defined as primarily someone who allegedly committed her crime against an abusive intimate partner. She's a survivor of domestic violence. And in my situation, it was a very domestic situation, but it wasn't an intimate partner against whom I was defending my life. So in so many ways, a lot of incarcerated survivors are marginalized outside of that definition, even though the circumstances are pretty much the same.
Can you talk to me a little bit about like the missing nuances in cases like this, like what it can really look like maybe for more marginalized people in all sorts of ways? It's kind of a broad question, but you've given me some really interesting ideas on that.
Well, one aspect that I find pretty interesting and awareness needs to be raised about is that, like you said, there is no one way that a criminalized survivor should look. There is no one textbook definition. Domestic violence itself has so many shades of gray. It's not clearly black and white. For instance, in my own situation, I am a survivor of domestic violence. And the thing that seems to be missing in a lot of people's stories that don't fit the textbook description is that we responded the same way that those who are serving time against their intimate partners did. We, too, have a history of surviving domestic violence. We, too, have a history, whether it was as a child brought up in the home and you grew up in an abusive situation. And so there's this thing, you know, I still ask this question, even though I'm on my way out the door. Where was the law when I needed defending? Where was the law when I needed protecting? When I did tell, and because I could not prove it wasn't on camera or because others who witnessed wouldn't substantiate it, now I'm making it up. But the one time I say, no, I need to fight back, it's either fight or die. Now I'm the monster, now I'm the murderer, and now society needs to be protected against me. Many of our stories are the same growing up, whether we wound up in abusive relationships or not. I have survived two abusive relationships. But the one common thread with most criminalized survivors is that we never got help for that. We never got treatment for that. We never got therapy for that. Because in a lot of our communities, we're told to just turn a blind eye to it. This is just what's normal. This is what happens. It's not right, but what can you do about it? And then we have the abusers who say, if you leave, I'm going to kill you and your kids. Or if you leave, I'm going to find you. If you leave, yeah, we have all of those elements are the same. But if my crime itself does not involve an abusive partner, then I don't get to identify as an incarcerated survivor. And I think that's a very sad commentary on the way justice determines who's the victim and who's the criminal. Because in so many situations like this, victims are on both sides of the courtroom. Victims are outside of the courtroom. There are children, our families, our communities, our people who relied on us. I worked as a kindergarten teacher. I mean, how many of those children saw me as like the one parental figure they may have had for the day? And I feel like because at the sentencing, the judge said, because I was a pillar in the community and a teacher by vocation, that I should have known better than to put myself in that kind of position.
Did you put yourself in that kind of position?
You know, I am learning. I'm exploring that possibility, because this is another thing. Throughout our journeys doing time or serving time, we are drilled, almost conditioned, to believe that, you know, you can't find true healing unless you take responsibility for what you did. So that's the first step. You take responsibility for what you did, even if in my case, I didn't pull the gun.
And I think you talked a little bit about, like, where was the law that was so completely competent in putting me away for 22 years, where was that law when I was a kid, when I needed it? Do you make a connection between your childhood and that day that you ended up in that altercation?
I connect the altercation with a culmination of events that happened. Not only what happened in the house growing up, not only with the two abusive relationships that I survived, but I also survived two random rapes. One when I was 6 months pregnant with my son that I almost lost. From the time that I was raped the first time up until the time of my arrest, I continued to miscarry children because of that rape. I could not carry children full term because there was a scar on my uterus that, unless I was on full bed rest, I could not carry children. So I've lost, well, had all my children been living by now, I would be a mother of six. But I have one son. I have one son, and God bless him. He turned out to be a fighter. He turned out to be a trooper. He said, I'm not going anywhere. Each time I've fought, you know, each time that something happened to me, I froze. I normally freeze. But this was the one time I actually fought back, you know. Mm-hmm. And while I sincerely regret what happened, you know, I for one don't say, oh, I'm completely innocent. My only argument is that I'm not a monster. I'm not a murderer. I didn't take anyone's life. I was just trying to save my own. And I still wrestle with, in the land of the free, if ever I were put in a position where it was my life or someone else's, how do I protect my life in a way that doesn't break the law? Because the message has been sent to me that saving my life was a crime. So I don't know, you know, what this means for me moving forward. I do know that I have tried to take the best and learn along the way. I've met some pretty amazing people along the way here. I do believe that survival instincts is what caused me to create the reentry possibilities that I have now. But moving forward, what are we telling women when they are in positions where you fight or die? What are we telling them?
He would lie his way into their dreams.
He was looking for James Bond girls.
How fun would that be to be a Bond girl?
Then twist them into a nightmare.
This guy's done this before. He'll do it again.
Until a group of women banded together to put him behind bars and keep him there.
You have to participate fiercely, fiercely in what happens next.
I'm Keith Morrison, and this is Murder in the Hollywood Hills, an all-new podcast from Dateline.
Listen to Murder in the Hollywood Hills for free each week, or subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com to unlock new episodes 1 week early.
there. It's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Every Wednesday, tune into The Deep Dive for a hilarious and heartfelt journey with hosts June Diane Raphael and Jessica St. Clair. From navigating the chaos of motherhood and family to exploring the depths of grief and loss, June and Jessica are two best friends who process life together. Discover their secrets to finding joy amidst the madness. Get ready for unfiltered conversations about life, love, and everything in between. June and Jessica believe in the power of connection and the strength that comes from supporting one another. You can listen to The Deep Dive on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you feel like, and if so, how do you feel like race and gender fit into the idea that saving your life was a crime? Like, would a white man in the same situation have ended up with 22 years in prison?
Absolutely not. I don't believe he would have. I have tangible situations from my own lived experience that sends that message to me that because I am an African-American woman, that the time for me is more than what anyone else would serve. So it just sends the message that, you know, maybe I'm the wrong color and I'm the wrong gender, you know? So maybe in the eyes of the law, my life is disposable, or it can be justified that I don't fight back and I wind up in the ground.
Was trauma, like women with trauma, you know, people in women's facilities with trauma, was that a common theme? That's what I hear, but I'm wondering from your experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Over, I would say, if I were going to put a number on it, over 85% of us are survivors of some kind of violence, some kind of trauma. Whether it was a childhood trauma, traumas we endured as adults, or a combination of both. I can't recall, I maybe can count on maybe one hand, I'll say, where I've talked to women where violence or domestic violence or trauma was not a part of their story. Yes.
So, okay. What would have helped you? What could have been done before all of this?
I think that even as that seventh grader who mustered up the courage to tell her teacher what was going on, and when child services came out and investigated, maybe if even my story were investigated, you know, that might would have made a difference. As that 19-year-old who was trying to get an order of protection against her abusive boyfriend, maybe if the judge had upheld that order of protection, things might would have been different. Wow, maybe for the man who raped me the first time and the second time, maybe if the law stepped in and took those men off the street earlier, that maybe the trajectory of my life would have gone differently. Had my side of the story actually been investigated, you know? So I do think that officers of the law should be seeking justice rather than a conviction. There's a difference between the two. We trust you to get to the bottom of the things and to take facts and twist them to support a truth in order to get an extended or a high sentence. That's not justice. That's not justice at all. And I'm not sure if, you know, on a
societal scale that we collectively see how much this hurts not only the victims, because that's not true justice for them, but also justice impacted people and our families, and it affects us overall. And we haven't even began to cover the economic cost of this.
I think you've talked to me a little bit about like the idea of the violent offender, and why you think that's kind of a false label. Can you expand on that just a little bit?
I've gotten to the place where I'm frankly offended at the term violent offender, because one can have a violent offense. You can be charged with a violent offense and not be a violent offender. I am a first-time quote-unquote offender. Never been in trouble with law. Have not been in trouble inside. Violent offender is based solely on what brought you inside, not on the character of the person that you are. You don't need a history of demonstrated violence to be classified as a violent offender. It's solely on your conviction. And I think that's wrong.
What is life like in the semi-free world? Semi-free, because you're in this program. Like, what is that after 21 years to be out? Like, what does it feel like? How does it feel?
It gives me a sense of hope. It does have its own set of challenges, because I have like 1 foot in the system and 1 foot on its way out. So trying to get a sense of what I am able to choose from and what's not my choice, what I am responsible for and what I'm not, it gets very gray area-ish. But I'm definitely very hopeful. And so as hard and as heartbreaking as this journey has been, at some point I can look forward to rebuilding mine. No matter how much time I've served or no matter how much time I spend in the free community, I will always regret what happened. And so I think of freedom as using my life to pay it forward.
Do you hold on to anger that you have to?
No. Anger works like cancer. It only eats away at the person holding it. I get passionate about some things. You know, I do. I get passionate about it. But anger serves no purpose, especially if it's not the type of anger that will effect change. You know, there's a healthy kind of anger. I'm angry about this, so let's do something about it. But angry as in becoming bitter or resentful, there's no room for that, because I have to remember, especially in my own situation, this domestic altercation cost a life. It did cost a life. I find myself talking to a lot of the young women that are back here and trying to, you know, impart wisdom and maybe share my lived experiences with them so that they don't make the same mistakes.
What's one of the most important things you think for them to know? What's one of the most important things you can tell them?
You are worthy. You are worthy. No one has the right to devalue who you are. No one has the right to define who you are. So many times they base who they are on what brought them here. And I'm like, you're so much more. You're so much more. Your one instance in your life does not permanently define your identity. And even more importantly than that, you get to choose how you identify. Yeah. That's been a life changer for me. Once I knew I could choose who I wanted to be, I think that's what set me off and put me on a different life path.
Believe Her is a co-production of Lemonada and Spiegel & Grau. I'm your host and lead reporter, Justine Vanderloon. This bonus episode was produced by me and our associate producer, Julia Yort. The Believe Her production team includes me and our supervising producer, Kristen Lepore, our associate producer, Julia Yort, and our production assistant, Rory James Leach. Mixing and sound design by Keegan Zema. Music by Sara Abdallal. Our executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax, Jessica Cordova-Kramer, and Spiegel & Grau. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse,
use a safe computer and contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233. If you have experienced sexual assault and need support, visit RAINN at RAINN.org or call 1-800-656-HOPE. Help others find our show by leaving us a rating and writing us a review. Follow us at Lemonada Media across all social platforms or find me at Justine VDL. You can also get more bonus content and behind-the-scenes material by subscribing to Lemonada Premium. You can subscribe right now in the Apple Podcasts app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button. If you want to continue the conversation with other listeners, please join our Believe Her podcast community on Book Clubs. Join for free at bit.ly/Believe Her Book Clubs. That's bit.ly/Believe Her Book Clubs, clubs with a Z. Thanks so much for listening.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Think about a moment in your life that changed you, where one day you were yourself, and then the next day, poof, you weren't. I'm Stephanie Whittles-Wax, host of the show Last Day, and each week I sit down with a new guest to explore happy, sad stories of transformation. Some last days are hopeful, some are tragic, but on the other side of every last day is a fresh start. Come laugh cry with us. Listen to Last Day wherever you get your podcasts.